Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello, and welcome back to Waiting for Doom, the world's greatest Doom Patrol-related podcast, where we talk non-stop about our favorite superhero team, the mighty Doom Patrol.
Hey, everyone, I'm Paul. You can find me on Twitter at reading_hicks, and send us emails to waitingfordoom@gmail.com, and we're on Facebook in the usual way that people are on Facebook, except we're a show, and we're on Facebook in that way, which is slightly different but similar. And you can send – no, you can't. You can't send anything to this. Well, you can if you want, but there's a website called mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com, which is run by our good friend Doug. Doug Savisha. I'm a bit of a Doug addict. He's awesome. And you can find all our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com, except for half of today.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Podbean. Yeah, and then Wilfred thought, oh, no, the episodes will still be all there on iTunes. No. They weren't working there either. No. technology. Anyway, yes, hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvantGarve. You can also find on Twitter our sentient show account, who is Wilfred. His handle is at WFDPod. And as always, we are proudly brought to you by Comicosity.com.
Yes, Comicosity is a fantastic site. Every week it is updating with new stuff. But one of the things they do every week is this little column called the Honor Roll, where people submit, contributors to the site submit the things that stood out for them from the previous week. So they pick panels from comics that they read. And that is always a treat. So this week, you know, there's a bit of Action Comics in there. There's something called Sherlock Frankenstein and the Legion of Evil.
Cool.
bit of a combo comic there. There's one from Thanos or Thanos or the Noz, depending on how you want to say it. And Doomsday Clock, got to mention. So people like these things and they point out pages that they think are awesome. And, it makes me think I should read some of this stuff. I'm very intrigued by Sherlock Frankenstein and the Legion of Evil.
It sounds right up your alley, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway. So how was your week in comics, Mike?
I actually read some comics.
Ooh.
Other than the ones we'll be discussing on this episode. I have to actually tip my hat to you, sir, for putting me on to the hardcover edition of The Button crossover between Batman and The Flash with its very fancy, what's the word I'm looking for? Not holographic.
Lenticular.
That's the one. I knew it had more than two syllables.
Yeah. It's made out of lentils. That's what it's.
Right. Fair enough. What else would you want to do with lentils? Ugh.
Yeah.
So yes, I read that. I thought it was okay. I think the art was better than the story, but the story did its job as a prelude to the Doomsday Clock.
Or a prelude to something else further down the track, perhaps. Because I found it intriguing. You know, that was what I came away from it. And yeah. I thought, probably, like, I've read most of that Flash run as it's been coming out, and I thought they were the best two issues of the Flash from that run.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Some of it's disappointing, but those two, they were good. I loved them.
Yeah, I didn't dislike it. I thought, it was okay. It didn't wow me. But, yeah, there's enough things in there that have my interest for upcoming future shenanigans in the DCU. What about you, Paul? What have you been up to?
Future Shenanigans in the DCU is the name of the crossover after Doomsday.
Yes, I finally wormed my way into the DC bullpen, and I'm naming all their events now.
I've been lying on Twitter.
Oh. So
I sent a picture of a great big pile of books and said, oh, I better look at my reading pile. And it's not really my read pile. I got new bookshelves on the weekend. I am relocating all my books from an old crappy bookcase to a much larger, imposing, hall scarring set of bookcases.
Oh, dear. Your poor hallway.
Yeah, but I'm hoping that there is enough shelves here that I can pull in. Like, I have all my DC stuff pretty well sorted on two bookcases, and then I had drawers full of sort of the non-DC and the Vertigo and yeah, I'm hoping I can pull all of it into one big bookcase.
Nice.
Yeah, four cubbies and they go up six high. So, and I'm about two thirds of the way through doing it, and I don't think it's all going to fit. Hey.
Whoops.
Yeah. So.
And how has that news been received by the rest of your household?
I've kept that news to myself. So.
Right. No one else tell anyone in Paul's family.
Yeah, they stopped listening to the show a long time ago.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
Cool. Well, not really. Yeah, but anyway.
If you haven't, I love you. I love you, hon. Love you. Do it because I can't think straight around you because you're so beautiful. Anyway. Oh,
nice save.
Yeah.
Speaking of beautiful, how about we go and have a look at what's going down on Durrington Way, maybe?
Sure. Okay, so this week on looking at what's happening on Durrington Way, I want to co-opt this segment, and rather than do news, I want to go back to talking about issue 9 from last week, because I, in the middle of the episode last week, I think I said, and someone's going to tell us things that we missed about this, and behold, someone has. So Aunt Gray got in contact, and he, so at the robots at the start, the with the people inside, Cookie and Nolan.
And Nolan, yes.
Yes, Martin identified where Cookie and Nolan are from, and they are from My Greatest Adventure 83, the fourth ever issue to feature the Doom Patrol.
Wow.
They are two criminals who use Negative Man to commit crimes. So he's sort of running amok, and they use the disruption he causes to commit crimes, and they get caught by the Doom Patrol and put away. And that explains a bit more about the issue. So those drawers with the long boxes on top and then like filing cabinets, but they've got people inside them, they are characters who are no longer in use in comics. So that's what the disappointment is looking after. So so it all sort of fits together well. So you've got comic boxes on top that are feeding into these drawers where these characters who are no longer in use in comics. It's a bit similar to the limbo that Grant Morrison mucked around with, but far more obscure. So Cookie and Nolan were petty crooks in that. So they were brought out and used by the disappointment to affect the Doom Patrol continuity in a way to make them more, I guess, pliable by shipping two of the characters, so making Jane and Cliff fall in love, make the comic more soap opery, you know, more traditional. But the Doom Patrol is very resistant to these changes, so they didn't stick, as we saw. So that's another piece of the puzzle that, you know, we were sort of getting to it, but now it's really coming into high-definition focus.
Yeah, and thank you and well done to Martin for coming across that. Because, I mean, what, My Greatest Adventure 83, we talked about that issue way back in episode 5.
Yeah.
So it's been a while.
And I don't think we even would have called out the names of Cookie and Nolan in that comic.
They would have just been two Grimms, basically.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, they don't really look the same. They were two real old grizzled crooks in the original story. In this one, they look like kind of young guys in, you know, sort of little jumpsuits. But, yeah, it also sheds light on the fact that the people who are looking after this, they look like sort of, you know, DC staffers. So it's got that you know, comic character custodians, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, able to access characters when they need them and put them back into circulation. So, very clever, Gerard Way. Very clever.
Very meta.
Very meta. I wonder if this would have, you know, hit us stronger later if Martin hadn't been so on the ball. Or would it forever have eluded us? Anyway.
Yeah, well, it's not awkward at all.
Anyway, well done, Martin. You have saved our bacon.
Yes. I will award Martin 10 pony points.
Okay.
So he only needs another 10,000 to go.
9,990 or something.
No, 10,010. Oh, going so, great for that's, a pun. Okay. Just to be difficult about it.
Just to make sure it never happens.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that the sound of ticking that I'm now hearing in my ears?
It is, thank goodness. And over there, it is the one and only, the Doom Clock. So we look upon the face of the mighty Doom Clock, and it's telling us that the last Doom Patrol book we had in our hot hands came out 1 week ago. Woohoo!
Woohoo!
Issue 9 of Volume 6, which we covered in Episode 112, and gave us the return of Mr. Nobody and his all-new, all-different Brotherhood of Nada. Oh, yeah. Love that brutalist architecture villain. Sorry.
It's good to have a different one to talk about, finally, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. We were also introduced to the Disappointment and given some hints as to his nefarious plans for retconning reality. So it was worth the wait for me. Worth the wait. Yeah. Issue 10 is at this stage, scheduled for release on January 24th of 2018. A whole 8 weeks away.
It hasn't moved.
I stand by my at this stage comment. Better to be prepared for more, pardon the pun, disappointment than to, you know, just naively skip through life.
Yes.
Take that to the bank, kids.
Waiting for Doom.
This week in Doom Patrol history, with thanks to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, going on sale for a mere 12 cents. On December 2nd of 1965, with a cover date of February 1966, was issue 101 of Doom Patrol Volume 1. Ooh. The creative team of Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani brought us two stories, the first being I, Cranus, Robot Emperor, in which the patrol not only took on Cranus, but also Nicholas Galtry, the evil guardian of Gar Logan, the Beast Boy. Before, the patrol then received a distress call from the Challengers of the Unknown, leading into an adventure in issue 48 of their comic. And the second story was titled The Lonely Giant, which continued the origin story of Cliff Steele, Robot Man, which had begun back in issue 101.
Right.
Yes, lots of stuff going on there. And,
yeah, Cranus used to get teased at school.
Did he?
Yeah, people used to rhyme his name, and he used to get angry.
What did they rhyme his name with, Paul?
Let's keep it classy, Mike.
Look, as Paul Kupperberg once said on this show, you know, we can say what we want because we're Australian. Oh, dear. Anyway, we covered issue 101, along with issue 102 and issue 48 of Challengers of the Unknown, all the way back in episode 36, which featured our guest star and fellow Doom bro, Doug Zavisha. So that was a lot of fun, that one. So you can check that episode out for more details. And that is it for the Doom Clock this week.
Batman and Booster Gold, hero from the 25th century.
Hello, my name is Jay. Some of you know me as FKA Jason, or the Captain Atom guy, or even the Wild Dog guy. I'm all of those and less. I am also a geek. Wait, can I use that word? Let me start again.
Captain Nathaniel Adams.
General Eiling, sir. What brings you to... What's this?
Orders. Your commission has been reactivated. You're back in the Air Force.
I'm committed to the Justice League now, sir.
Hi, I'm Jay, and I like comics. I podcast about them, and I've roped my friends into helping me. I have 6 shows I want to tell you about. Silver and Gold Podcast is a show I do with my buddy Roy. We talk about DC Comics, Captain Atom, and Booster Gold. On Beatlemania, my pal Tim and I talk about Blue Beetle.
I'm Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle.
On Charlton Comics Throwback, I ramble on about the Silver Age Captain Atom and other wonderful Charlton books with my son Vance. I'm also host of Wild Pod, a Wild Dog podcast. That's the one where I gush about DC's bad boy, Wild Dog.
Rene Ramirez, you need to decide if you want to be a man in a hockey mask or if you want to be someone else. Something else.
But those aren't the only shows we put out. Roy's DCV Marvel pits a randomly selected DC character against a randomly selected Marvel character, and they fight to the death. And on Scarab and Cinema, Tim Wallace talks about his favorite movies. All of these shows come out whenever we feel like it, and can be found at sngpod.com, on iTunes, Shout Engine, and Stitcher. Just search for SNG Productions. Stay gold, keep it blue, throw it back, and never let sleeping dogs lie with us at the SNG Pod family of podcasts. You might find something to appeal to the geek in you.
And now on to everyone's favorite segment of the show, where we dive deeper into issues of the Doom Patrol throughout their various runs and incarnations. And this week, we inch ever closer to the end of Volume 2 as we take a look at issues 84 and 85. And Paul's going to kick off with issue 84.
Yeah, just let me get a run up and off we go. Doom Patrol 84, it cover dated itself as November 1994, but it actually came out in itself on October 4th, 1994. It's $1.95, so yeah, under $2, pretty good. Mm-hmm. Edited by Lou Stathis, and it has the title of A Song for the Small Face. Written by Rachel Pollack, art by Ted McKeever, lettered by John E. Workman Jr., our favorite Johnny Workman. And yeah, it has a cover by Kyle Baker featuring two of the characters inside the comic clutching each other, one in distress and one dead. So
yeah.
Neither of them members of the Doom Patrol.
No.
No. But it is a bold visual.
It is a bit striking. There's a fair bit of anguish in that cover.
Yes, and it has the little catchphrase at the top, Dream Stealers, Flesh Peelers, and Resurrected Healers.
Mm.
Yeah, not blue healers, resurrected healers. Little bit of an Aussie reference.
Yep. Yeah. Meanwhile, anyway. everyone else in that audience dives onto Wikipedia. What's blue healers?
Or just doesn't. Anyway, I'll take you through what happens inside. So it starts 5 years ago in Israel in a cemetery amidst a sea of lit candles, and a man who we see is Rabbi Chaim, or Haim, perhaps, the rabbi who approached Willoughby Kipling about help and got sent towards the Doom Patrol in one of the previous issues.
Mm-hmm.
He prays to the holy Rabbi Isaac for help, and he says the world is filled with pain and death is hidden all around. And in fact, as he says, his corpses are watching him from the and he can't see them. So he knows about it, but he's not really looking where he is. Anyway, mm-hmm. Isaac, Haim's Rabbi, which is like a mentor?
Mm, yeah. Yes.
Rises from the grave and chides Haim for listening to the false dream. In raising him, he has opened a hole for the enemy. And behind him, this frame of light that we've seen hovering around before turns up. And he turns to see Joseph Della Reina, another dead man walking. And the frame blasts Rabbi Haim, and Della Reina seizes the risen Rabbi, and he will help them whether he wishes to or not. And the frame opens a portal, and they depart. That was 5 years ago, in Israel. Nice. Anyway, in the present day, in Violet Valley, which is the home of the Doom Patrol these days, Dorothy is messing about with her imaginary friends, setting up imaginary dates, when Cliff interrupts to see if she wants to come with he, Kate, and Cerise, who's the female cult lady featured in previous issues, to hear a New Age rabbi talk. She declines, very sensibly. Cliff should decline. No one should be getting off to that. But after he leaves, she finds a pottery shard on the floor, and Charlie the doll in the room yells for her to be careful, but she is suddenly swept up by a vision of a flaming chariot bearing down on her, and suddenly wings appear in front of her to shield her face, and she is back in the room, dazed and confused, like the movie. Charlie says a quick prayer for peace, and she forgets the incident, but Charlie promises when she returns to the deep, he will travel with her next time.
Ooh. Right.
In the Violet Valley Township, Rabbi Haim is making his way towards the Doom Patrol when giant stilt-like angel birds attack him. Weird. He thanks Hashem, the name, one of the names of God, for dirt to plug his ears as others collapse in pain around him. And then he grabs a discarded frisbee and he scrawls some Hebrew characters on it and flings it at the angel birds and it cuts them to pieces.
Cool.
Deadly frisbees.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. At the New Age Rabbi Samuel Goldbum pulls a blind man out of the audience and heals him in front of everybody with the light from this familiar-looking frame of lights that we've seen being sinister previously. Mm. Cliff calls it bullshit, whereas Cerise fears something more sinister than bullshit. And Rabbi Goldbum asks the healed man to accompany him backstage. Niles, meanwhile, is getting his chocolate milk on with his symbiotic, sexually remainted spirit companion, Alice, wired for sound. And he's drinking chocolate milk in a very erotic way, considering that Alice's his head is strapped to Alice's stomach and the chocolate milk spills all over her crotch. Okay.
Yeah.
And Dorothy interrupts them to say that Charlie wishes to speak with him. As Cliff and Kate are leaving the rally, Cliff's body suddenly projects an image of the chief from a projector that he didn't know he had embedded in his body. And the chief tells them that Charlie has requested that they immediately head to the park. Cliff, although upset that he has a hidden projector in his body, he trusts Charlie and wants to do what Charlie says. So they head to the park. And they arrive where Rabbi Haim is being attacked by more angelic monsters. So there's like these giant tops chucking spikes, like dreidels.
Yeah.
The spike, you know, the tops are like dreidels, not the spikes. Anyway, Kate dissolves these spikes just before they hit Rabbi Haim. And then Cliff smashes up the spinning top forms. And Rabbi Haim praises Hashem that he has found the Doom Patrol in his time of need. Back at the rally, out of sight of the audience, the blind man, or the former blind man in this case, suddenly feels weird as his eyes begin to hurt. He puts his hand over his eyes and he begins to burn from the inside and he collapses as an immolated skeleton in front of the 10-pointed frame of lights. That can't be good.
No, it can't.
Yeah. So, this one is a bit of an A to B direct journey and, you know, not too much to ponder, really.
Well, true, but I'll have to admit I had to do a bit of looking up as to who Joseph de la Reina was and who Akatriel was that Rabbi Haim calls out to when he uses his frisbee of power.
Yep.
So, yeah, did it. Yeah, you're right. It's fairly straightforward, but there's lots of Jewish mysticism stuff going on.
Yeah, so what did you discover when you powered up Google?
When I fired up the interwebs, apparently Joseph de la Reina is a hero of Kabbalistic legend who attempted to bring an end to Satan's power and lead to a redemption for mankind. Part of his downfall and his undoing was that Joseph burnt incense before Satan, and that was considered to be idolatry.
Ooh.
That was his undoing. Akatriel is apparently an angel who is the revealer of the divine mysteries and an angel of proclamation.
Right.
So, and the word Shem...
Akatriel's been name-dropped a few times.
Yes. Yeah. So when... Haim is saying Akatriel Shem. He's literally calling on the name of Akatriel. Apparently Shem means renown or prosperity or name. So he was sort of calling on the power of Akatriel to power up his super frisbee to decapitate the angel bird stilt monster things.
Okay. So my Nick Shem is Flanger.
Sure.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Flanger Shem. Right. But, yeah, it's Rachel Pollack is really putting her stamp on this final arc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one can assume that she has a Jewish heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps.
Perhaps, yes.
Yeah, and certainly mining it. So, I mean, she's done this before, is picking up legend stories and, you know, things that, you know, aren't just made up, but they come from, you know, tales of the past.
Yeah, well, exactly, with the whole Tiresias Wars storyline. Yeah. You know, it wasn't until you and I dug a bit deeper that we found out, oh, hang on, it's not made up. Tiresias has appeared in ancient literature beforehand. Cool.
Yeah.
Interesting to see Charlie the Living Doll sort of reveal some more of his powers when he uses when the wings appear to protect Dorothy. They kind of fold back in on Charlie's body.
So they were Charlie's wings.
That's the way I saw it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because the burning chariot's coming straight for her, and the only other person is Charlie in the room, and she's protected by the wings, and then when the chariot vanishes, there's sort of the light coming from behind Charlie, and then when he, you know, lays his hand upon her and, you know, brings her to peace, that's how I interpreted that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I must admit, with Ted McKeever's art, there is a bit of interpretation required at times.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, like when I said it's a flaming chariot, it may be a flaming chariot. It's definitely a chariot. But I'm not sure if it's flaming, but it's doing something spectacular.
It's got lots of lights and it looks hot temperature wise. So we'll say flaming. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an okay start to the final arc.
It's an okay story. It just doesn't feel like a Doom Patrol story at all.
No. Not really. When you look back at where Volume 2 started, even, and even when Morrison came along, it's completely different once again.
Yeah, well, the only two Doom Patrollers who get a real focus in this is Dorothy, who's sort of, you know, playing with her imaginary friends, like, you know, setting them up on dates and, you know, using them to help her get some lipstick on and things like that. So she gets a bit more characterization. And there's the continued hints that Dorothy is, you know, developing her sexual identity as such and, you know, wanting to be more glamorous and, you know, attractive. And the other person who probably gets a little bit of work in this issue is the Chief.
Oh, yeah, Chief works on it, right.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's like literally his head is nestled beneath the breasts of Alice White for Sound and above her crotch. And, when he's drinking his chocolate milk, there's chocolate milk all over those locations.
Yes.
And
Alice is quite enjoying it too.
Yeah, she is panel. Into it.
Yeah. She's even helping feed Niall some of the chocolate.
Well, smearing it around. I'm not sure if it's going in the right places. But I mean, it's quite revolting that it's gushing out his neck as he drinks it. It's all over her crotch. Anyway, interesting.
Yeah. Bit of something for everyone.
Yeah, we're definitely in a Vertigo book now.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And the cover is Rabbi Haim holding the dead Rabbi Isaac. So, and very bold graphics by Carl Baker.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not the slightest bit Doom Patrol-y, I reckon.
Not at all, no.
Anyway, shall you proceed?
Shall, with issue 85, which had a cover date of December 1994, but went on sale November 1st of that year, with a cover price of $1.95 still, edited once again by Lou Stathis, written by Rachel Pollack, art from Ted McKeever, letters once again by Johnny Workman Jr. And this is part two of the final story arc, Imagine Ari's Friends. And this chapter is called Gates of Light. And the cover is a little bit disturbing. It has the tagline, Losing Face, Finding Faith. And there is a person on the front literally ripping away their skin and showing a slightly more horrendous being underneath.
Hmm.
And if you look closely at their eyes, it looks like there are cups in there.
Yeah. Sort of like traditional grail cups rather
yes.
than
yes.
like plastic tumblers.
No. No. Not little teacups or anything. Yeah. Grail cups. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Anyway, as we open the issue, we are taken to an Oneiric Research Center. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Do you know what Oneiric relates to, Paul?
Something in the comic?
It actually relates to dreams or dreaming.
Huh.
So it's a dream research center.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I had lots of fun looking up all sorts of stuff on the interwebs. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, in this dream research center, a patient is babbling about needing to find his father's cup hidden in the basement. But to do so requires him to jump off a roof, avoiding screaming trees and blinding lights. As two of the Dream Center staff look over this patient, the room begins to get brighter as a glowing form appears behind him. And it's this 10-pointed form we've seen a few times before, which, I'll spoil it now, it's called a Sephiroth.
Right.
Yes, and we'll get to that more a bit later. So the glowing Sephiroth appears. Again, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The woman vaguely recalls what this pattern means before the wall explodes, killing her and her co-worker. The two robed figures that we saw in the previous issue from backstage at Rabbi Goldbaum's last speech, they enter the room and say to the now wide awake and confused patient, "These are the words of Rabbi Joseph Della Reina. In every time there shall come seven dreamers." The patient is suddenly hit with energy blasts and burnt alive in their bed. One of the robe figures reaches into the patient's rib cage and retrieves a cup. And they hold it high and they continue, "And these dreamers shall hold alive the unbroken vessel, waiting for the mouth who knows how to drink."
Mm. Okay.
Meanwhile, in Violet Valley, Cliff and Kate have returned to Rainbow Estates with Rabbi Kame, who does his best to deal with his startling introductions to George and Marion, the bandage people, and the sexually remanded spirits. Clate leave Haim in a room alone for a minute while they go round up the rest of the team, and this is when Charlie the Living Doll appears before him and says, "Reb Haim, Shalom, act quickly and please close the door." Haim falls to his knees, shouting, "Master, forgive me!" But the doll calms him and offers him some strange-looking bread or cake. I can't tell what it's meant to be. It's food of some sort.
Mm.
And the doll says to him, "This food is the secret names of vision. Eat them, and when you speak, your voice will open gates." Of course.
Mm. Okay.
Back in Brooklyn, Rabbi Goldbaum has finished another of his speeches and is backstage stripping off. He descends a long flight of stairs before coming to another Sephiroth, this time on a wall, and he recites, "Who is like you, Hashem? You stretched out your hand and the dark earth has engulfed them." Goldbaum then begins peeling away his flesh, revealing a much thinner and gaunt-looking figure beneath. Before a doorway appears in the wall, he continues reciting, "A father shall not uncover his nakedness before the sight of his child. Blessed is Hashem, who permits the breaking of all that he has written." Right. Hmm. Back at DBHQ, Haim has met the rest of the team, and when asked about how they can help him, he insists on giving them a history lesson to explain the current danger. And so he tells them of Hashem's creation of the universe and the creation of the Sephiroth, the 10 branches on the Tree of Life, and the failure of this design to contain Hashem's light, which led to his exile from his own creation. This history lesson continues on with Rabbi Joseph Della Reina, who believed the world was broken and had suffered too much, and so he fasted and prayed for the Messiah to come save them. But instead of opening his heart to the Lord, his pride in wanting to heal the world alone took over, and he fell prey to the evil one, Satan.
Hmm.
Cursed with immortality, he spent centuries devising a new plan to heal the world. He would track down the perfect remaining vessel, a single cup that had been used by Adam and Eve before they sinned, by Noah on the ark, and by Joseph, son of Jacob. This cup separates itself into seven perfect vessels and hides within seven dreamers in every generation. If Deloraine gains all seven cups, his power will become absolute, for it is written, and Joseph dreamed and told it to his brothers. All the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me. And his father said, shall I and your mother and your brothers come down to you and bow down to the earth? Getting biblical. Yeah. Naturally, wanting to avoid yet another potential end to the world, Niles Calder offers the patrol's help. And the issue ends with Deloraine, previously Goldbaum, performing a vision ritual to determine who the last remaining dreamer and cup holder is. And of course, he's shown the face of the chief. Yeah.
Just an aside, I've noticed lots more people on podcasts saying dun 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 now than, and I reckon it's because of us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're welcome, other podcasts and listeners of those shows. So, or yes.
It could just be a thing from away.
No, it's us. It's us. We are the tastemakers. Anyway, yes. I was pleased to finally have a name for this 10-pointed form that's been appearing throughout the last few issues, and it's a Sephiroth. Again, hope I'm pronouncing that Roth. Correctly. No, it's not David Lee Roth. and the 10 points on that form are meant to represent the 10 emanations and attributes of God with which he continually sustains the existence of the universe. It's also seen as the process of the creation of the universe and a process of ethics. And it's related to the Kabbalah as well, which is, if I'm remembering correctly, a more mystically inclined offshoot of the Jewish religion. So, yeah, it's really interesting to read it, this issue, and do a bit more research into it. I've probably messed some of those things up that I've just said, but I read it very late last night. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is interesting, but I feel like Rachel should have got herself a separate mini-series to explore this rather than use the Doom Patrol, because there's so little Doom Patrol in it. Mm. Like, you know, I think the only real bit of Doom Patrol business is like Alice coming down with the chief, and then the chief, you know, the rabbi has to cover his eyes to avoid the nudity.
Yes.
And Alice does a bit of reconfiguring her wires to make little nipple cups.
Yeah, his introduction to the patrol in general is pretty much all we see of them this issue.
Yeah, and, you know, as soon as he walks in, there's, you know, naked boobs in his face from a sexually remanded spirit, you know, passing through the walls. But I did like that she had a Mona Lisa on the crotch, at least. A tiny little Mona Lisa portrait.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, interesting, but not really relevant.
No. That's the Doom Patrol.
At this stage.
At this stage, yeah. I do find it interesting that even though, well, Deloraine is being presented as, I guess, the enemy in this storyline. In a way, he almost reminds me of Mr. Nobody in that he's not... He wants to save the world and you know, save the world from all the harm it's been through. And I wonder if in the next part of the storyline, the patrol will be like, well, you know, he kind of wants to do good, but are we on the right side again? It's not, to me at the moment, it's not pure good and evil. It's like, he's not just, I am a villain because I'm a villain. It's like, I want to do the right thing, even though my methods are probably not the best. If I'm, you know, burning people to a crisp and retrieving these cups from their souls.
Yeah, well, he's corrupted by his hubris that he thinks he can help. Mm. And he's the only one who can do that. And, you know, and it's a typical, you know, means justify the ends.
Yeah, yeah.
Thing. But I'm reminded one of the nice things about a comic where you feature a team is, like, you give that team something to do in every issue. Like the classic JLA stories, you know, the JLA are presented with a problem and they all split up into pairs and go and, you know, have their little, you know, 3 or 4 page adventure to solve that problem. And then they all come together at the end. You know, I would love to see that in Rachel Pollack's run with the Doom Patrol, because the team, you know, very few of them get to shine. They don't get much to do. I mean, Cliff basically hits things, Kate dissolves things, but there's no characterization around these characters apart from Dorothy at the moment. It's it's lacking, and you know, it's, you know, the Doom Patrol has become a vehicle to explore things that interest Rachel Pollack rather than, you know, a way to explore the team.
Yeah, you're exactly right. These issues are more about the setup of what's happening, not so much how the patrol are going to deal with it. It's a lot of backstory on, you know, about Joseph DeLorena and about the Seven Cups. But hopefully they will have more to do in the next two issues, because this is a four-part story, and once it's done, that's the end of Volume 2.
This is a four-part story?
It is.
What?
Yeah.
Are we in part two or part three?
We've just covered parts one and two.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah. So that's how it's going to go out.
This is how it's going to go out.
Golly.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think it's in the back of this one they announced that the comic has been, they don't say cancelled, they say we're just going to put it aside for now so we can rejig it.
Right.
Which is editorial speak for it's cancelled.
Yeah.
And, you know, one cannot be surprised at this point. I mean, it's been a bold move away from the Morrison era, but I think it's been too bold.
We've said this before, that Rachel does bring some interesting things to the book, but it's forever in the shadow of Morrison's previous stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but it's no longer derivative at any point now.
No.
And, yeah, interesting. I think we'll talk more about, you know, what she brought to the book when we get to the finale of her run.
Mm-hmm. But,
I mean, these weren't boring.
No. They were actually really interesting to see the Judaism side of things from clearly her own background being brought into her work of fiction here.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's moved so far away from traditional things. Like the covers don't even feature the Doom Patrol. I mean, and all the covers we've had the last, you know, it's been, I think, probably the very first issue of the Pollack run that actually had like a team portrait, as it were. Since then, we haven't had anything like that. So,
no. You know,
it really is, you know, traveling and not a well-trod path for a hero team as such.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway.
Before we sign off from Doomsday, I just want to apologize again if we may have mispronounced any of the things we've covered in this section. Not being of the Jewish faith and having to research a lot of it, I feel a bit awkward pronouncing some of the things, so...
And even understanding some of the concepts. So, you know,
none
of this, I mean, we have to look it up to understand any of this or just get it from the comic itself. It's not
exactly,
you know, it's not part of our heritage. And we're two white boys from Australia. So.
Yes, very white boys from Australia. But having said that, I hope we've not offended anyone with the way we've discussed any of this or pronounced any of this. But I have to say, for myself, I've actually found it really interesting to research into it, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes up in the final two issues of this arc and this run.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that, Mark. Yes, we do want to be sensitive, and we don't want to be, you know, offending anyone.
No, not at all. No. Not
at all. At this stage.
That's next episode. Oh, yeah, because we're covering Burn next episode. God.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get to the mailbag.
Okay. And now it's the Mailbag of Doom, and this time we're dealing with the previous question that we gave you all, which was, what, in terms of comics and comic-related things, was the one that got away? And we heard from Young Animal Updates. Very excited to hear from Young Animal Updates. And they're at DC_YoungAnimal. If you follow them on Twitter, you will get Young Animal Updates. It's a bit of a surprise, but that's what they're dealing mostly. And they said, are we allowed to participate? And we, because it's definitely Prison Pit Issue 4. All copies I've found online are in the $80 to $200 range. Don't know if I'll ever be able to snag that, so I think it counts.
I'd never heard of it, and I haven't had a chance to research it, so I will be doing that after we record. That's, holy cow, it must be good.
Well, I hope it's not super cool, because it sounds very expensive.
Yeah.
Probably why I'm a trade waiter.
Yes. We then heard from Ryan Daly at RyanDaly01. And he chimed in with G.I. Joe issue 113, the only issue between issues 97 and 154 that I couldn't find on the newsstand when I was collecting. A favorite character dies in the issue, spoiler, and I found out in the letters column of a later issue. Never read it until it was collected in a trade 20 years later. Ouch.
I remember those days where you just couldn't find an issue.
Yes.
Yeah. Frustration. We heard from Martin Gray, who said, the Doom Patrol monthly schedule burn.
I almost want to say too soon, but I'm going to let it slide. we heard from Kevin at Astrakis One, who this week is going by the title Even Whittle Cake Rim. Right.
Keep them coming, and Kevin.
Kevin's one that got away was a chance to buy a pretty nice copy of Giant Size X-Men 1 for less than $100. I'm a dummy for passing that up.
Yeah, that's a comic that won't go down in value.
No. No.
We heard from Clinton Robson, who is at Coffee and Comics, the Coffee and Comics blog and the well-regarded podcast that we all listen to. And he said, I missed out on meeting both Danny Fingeroth and Neil Gaiman on separate occasions because I had to work. Still annoys me to this day. I met Neil Gaiman a long time ago when Sandman was coming out. He came to Sydney.
Oh, nice.
And he was signing at a local comic shop, and I got some things signed. I think I might have them still. I should check on that. I think I got a trade or two signed. Yeah,
you should take a pic of that and tag Clinton into it just to rub it in a little bit more.
Yeah, that would be the supportive thing to do.
That's how friendship works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. We also heard from Jonathan Dye, who said that his best friend gave him the first appearance of Blue Beetle for his birthday. Personal favorite, but it got lost in my move this last July.
Wow, that would be back in the Charlton. Oh, no, Blue Beetle predates Charlton. Which Blue Beetle? He goes way back to the, 40s, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you'll have to expand on that one, Jonathan. But yeah. Still, that's got to sting. Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks. Yeah. We got a comment on Facebook from Max Traver, who I think Max popped up for the first time in the previous ep. But
I think so,
He's into us.
Yes, yeah. Thanks, Max.
Yeah. He said, great episode as always. My answer to the big question this time around is technically more movie-related, but it's the Chris Reeve Superman movie, so I say it counts. Back around 2005, I was at a comic con in Massachusetts, and I went there to see Adam West and ended up paying $50 just to have him sign a photo he had at his table. Since my soon-to-be wife and I were moving into our first apartment together, that kind of hit my budget for the day. And I was on my way out when I made direct eye contact with Margot Kidder. She was sitting alone at her table with no fans before her. She visibly brightened up and smiled at me, and I turned away and kept walking, knowing I would only end up spending more cash if I went over there. In my shame, I made a few loops of the room, and as I was leaving, I saw her, that's Helen Slater of the Supergirl movie fame, had moved over to sit next to Margot so that anyone who wanted to talk to her had to come and see Margot by default. Feeling like an utter slug of a fan, I slinked out the door with my Adam West signature. I soon after that made a vow that I would make a point to visit Margot's table and spend some of my time and cash with her. Of course, since then, she has not been a guest at any convention that I've been able to attend. And it's this is my comic book convention confidential confession.
Wow.
Oh, that's sad. That's really sad.
It is a bit.
Yeah, I probably would have gone over and just said hi, yeah. even if I didn't spend any money, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's me. I live in Australia where we never see people like that up close.
Yeah. I still can't believe that I got to chat not just with you, because 1 year Paul came to Brisbane and we went to Oz Comic Con together, but I got to like hang out and chat with Greg Rucker.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
That was awesome.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Anyway. We got an email from Ange, our favorite doctor. Hello, Frack.
We need to have a doctor off between him and Frack to see who's the best doctor. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, we could make a game show out of My Doctor Rules or something, or incisions or something, you know.
Doctor. You know, oh, no, that one's taken. Anyway, Ange wrote in with this. Said, this is going to be like peeling off a scab. Thanks for making me open old wounds. About 7 years ago, my comic store got hold of a copy of Action Comics 252, the first appearance of Supergirl. It is the hole in my comic collection, the Grail. And they had one, a decent copy no less, and they were selling it for $400. And knowing I love Supergirl, they gave me first dibs. It was a score and a steal at that price. I could have had it, but $400 is $400. Not something I felt I could just pull from the bank all in one chunk. I could have, but I didn't think I should. Now, I'm a good customer at this place, so I asked if I could pay it off in two payments, $200 then and $200 in a couple of weeks. The store is one of a franchise, and my guy said he would do it, but the boss wanted to move the book. They knew they could get the whole price in one sum, and so they couldn't do the deal. But it was still mine if I wanted it. I could have had it. I decided to screw all the money away and take a chance the book would be available. The next week, I went into the store and the book was gone. It had sold the very day it was offered to me later that night. It was there and it was only $400. They could have rewarded my loyalty to the store. They knew I'd be good for the money. In different ways, I could have had it, but it got away. I have yet to see an affordable copy of the book since. The price of the issue has since skyrocketed, and I could have had it. I could have. Oh, God.
Ange.
Sorry, Ange.
You knucklehead.
I actually went and onto eBay after reading Ange's letter and looked up that issue. And, yeah, it's in the thousands now. For a really nice copy of it.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah.
Thousands, Ange. Mm. $400. You had it in the bank.
Yeah.
I mean, I there's multiple levels of faulty. I mean, I think the comic shop should have held it for you.
Yes.
Yeah. But you had the money, man.
Mm.
Wow.
Now, before we get to our answers for this week, we're going to backtrack a little bit and cover some correspondence we received related to Rachel Pollack stuff that we're going to cover now. So, Paul, if you'd cover an email we got from Arbad, please.
Yeah, so Arbad writes, Dear Mike and Paul, remember that time when I wrote right after the episode aired and my comments were timely, insightful and coherent? Doom Patrol version 2, volume 2, 83, False Memories was the most enjoyable issue of Pollock's run. I wouldn't say it's the most representative story of that run, far from it. Maybe issue 82 would fit better in that role with all the exploration of gender issues and mysticism. But issue 83 has a nice self-contained story with sound art and some interesting nods to longtime fans of the book, although you actually don't need to remember or know anything about the identity addicts / the false memory. In terms of character development, it highlights the courage and strength of Dorothy Spinner, as when she decided not to go to Danny the World at the end of Morrison's run, she now refused to succumb to the false memories' sweet talk. She opted for the real world again, despite all her difficulties to be accepted and to fit in. And by the way, about your comments on issue 82, maybe it did take too long for Dorothy to move on, too little too late, but I see it as the creative team's fault. Too bad there was not much time to develop it in this run. Regarding Kate, you're right. Comparing to the rest of the team, she was handed a much harder and more painfully altered past by the false memory. But what I find interesting here is that the false memory gave her a fake backstory from a typical female perspective. Bad marriage, abusive husband. Nothing about the trans issue at all. For all intents and purposes, she was treated like a thorough woman. And it works well in the story because here the readers will notice the false memory and it was indeed making things up. We know that it did not happen. And regarding Cliff's last scene, I loved his comments about meeting JF Kennedy 30 years earlier. It was a reminder that the book followed the same continuity of the Drake Premiani run, and it was all one long story, at least until Byrne happened. All the best, Fabio. Thanks, Albert. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
Good commentary there, yeah.
Mm.
The false memory issue was, you know, it is a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a nice little breather.
Hmm.
Yeah. And on the Facebook page, we got some comments from Ed LaTorre, which he's given us a link to a Tumblr post, which we'll get Wilfred to share and put up on the Twitter feed as well. And Ed wrote, listening to your episode about the false memory and your musing on why Kate was given a rape memory, think about this. How many times are female heroes retconned with sexual abuse in their backstory to artificially give them gravitas or depth or meaning? In that sense, is what the false memory did all that different from male comic writers, artificially introducing trauma as cheap shorthand to make characters quote-unquote better? If you want someone to have a much more deep analysis of these themes and other themes present in the Pollack run, check out the link that Ed shared with us. It's a good blog post about what they took as the central themes of Pollack's Doom Patrol. And yeah, it's from judedeluca.tumblr.com and shared Jude's thoughts on Rachel Pollack's entire run. So check that one out. We'll get Wilfred, yeah, to share it. Some interesting stuff there. Thanks, Ed. Much appreciated. Mm,
thanks.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Paul, what was your one that got away?
Nothing earth-shattering. Probably, the first one that got away, but I managed to get it back, was one of the first times I ever got on eBay. Like, I just set up an eBay account and I did a search for the very first Alan Moore Swamp Thing issue. And, ooh, you know, I had no idea how eBay worked. And so I put in a bid and I sat and watched it and watched it and watched it. And then I got sniped at the last second and lost it. And I was like, ah! But that was a learning exercise for me because, you know, a few years later I had another crack at that issue because this issue was not collected because it was sort of – it wasn't in the trades because it was the issue that sort of wrapped up everything that had gone in the previous run.
Right.
And then Alan Moore started afresh with the Anatomy Lesson, which is his famous, you know, groundbreaking issue. But it's technically his second issue on Swamp Thing. So a few years later, I managed to get that one at a reasonable price by sniping someone else. Yay, high five.
It's the circle of sniping life.
Yeah, yeah. But I think last year at the Supernova Con, or was it this year? I think it was this year, in fact. I was wandering around looking at all the stores. My daughter was selling stuff, so I helped her set up. And then, you know, as soon as I could, I got away to go and look at what the dealers were selling.
Right.
And there's a comic. It's JLA versus it's DC versus Marvel's JLA Avengers, I think it is.
Okay.
Written by Kurt Busiek. I think it's got George Perez artwork and everything. And this came out years ago, and I ignored it because I thought, I'll buy the trade of it. And then the only trade they brought out was this really big, like an absolute hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
So really pricey book. And I, you know, I balked at it and thought, I'll wait for the cheap version. Cheap version never came out, ever. So, I missed out on that comic. You can't buy it online or anything. It's very expensive. And I was just wandering around. I saw it at one of the dealers. And I thought, oh, okay. And it was, I think it was like $100. And it was very reasonably priced. Or maybe it was $120. It was something. And I thought, oh, okay. Oh, maybe I should. And then I didn't really think about it. And I think I was just had cheap comic frenzy. You know, I was looking for cheap things. Mm-hmm. And I just wandered off. And then I think a few hours later, I thought, geez, I really better buy that. It's really hard to get. And it was gone, of course. Yeah, and then I looked it up on eBay and wept, genuine tears of sadness. And yeah, so if you are someone who owns those comics and you can lend them to me, because really I just want to read them, but
right.
That seems the only way I can get them is to buy the book. And yeah, because it's not a Comixology because of the cross company information stuff. Anyway, yeah, sad. Sadness.
Wow. Wow. Jeez.
What have you got, Mike? What's your answer? What? Got away from Mike.
The only one I could think of recent times was when I was last at Heroes Con, and I came across issue 121 of Doom Patrol, the final issue of Volume 1.
Ooh, yes.
Now, see, this was my second time at Heroes Con, and it was very last minute, and I didn't have a lot of money to spare. So I could have bought it, and I would have survived the rest of the weekend, but it would have been pretty tight. So I thought, you know what? I'll hide it away back in this box. I'll come back for it, because no one's going to want this. Who would want this? And, you know, I think I didn't go back to that dealer until maybe the next day when they were, you know, when they're starting to pack everything up and they reduce their prices. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll look at. I couldn't find it. It was gone. Either it was gone or I just hit it so well that I shot myself in the foot. But, yeah, I could have had it for, I think it was, I don't know, maybe 100 or something. Or a bit less than that, but you know, but it was like in perfect condition.
Wow!
There was no tears, creases, nothing.
That'd be a good one to get slapped, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't know about slabbing for me, because I like to be able to read them, and once they're slabbed, that's it.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was the one that came to mind, that I could have had that, but no. I thought I'd be responsible with my money at a comic convention, of all things. Yeah, and well, that'll learn me. I'll never be responsible with money ever again.
You knucklehead.
Yep. Oh, dearie me. It's very traumatizing.
Oh, dear.
It came out with that question.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that bittersweet note, I think we'll start signing off. Next time on the show, we are returning to the John Byrne run. Huzzah!
Woo!
Issues 5 and 6, which I believe are the ones that cover the underground illegal robot fighting ring.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Robot Wars.
Robot Wars. Oh, yeah. And we've got a new question of the week. What is that question, Paul?
What comic habit have you broken out of? So something you used to do that you no longer feel the need to do with comics.
Oh, I've got a good one.
Oh, good.
I'll save it for next week because it's a bit snarky.
Ooh.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Anyway, yeah. So if you want to respond to that question, you can get in touch with us at Twitter or WFDpod. You can send us the emails to waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You've got 280 characters on Twitter. Email much longer. You can put in pictures. You can do a song. You can send us a voicemail, whatever you like. We have the Facebook page. You can get in touch there. And there, of course, is Doug's site, mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com. Go have a look at Doug's site. He always puts up the pictures for these episodes, and he does a great job.
Yeah.
And his site is well worth a visit. Many hours of interesting Doom Patrol stuff there waiting. And I think that's all we've got time for now, Mike.
Yeah, it is. Us done for another week. Thanks, Paul. And thanks everyone for joining us. Catch you again next time for more Waiting for Doom.
Waiting for Doom.